picture the shark in the movie Jaws, or just picture the meanest looking shark you can imagine right now. Now try to imagine what a 200-pound shark hooked up on the end of your fly rod and jumping 20 feet out of the water would feel like. Hooking sharks on the fly is what today's guest specializes in. Conway Bowen makes his living finding and getting clients hooked up with the baddest top of the food chain fish in the ocean. And today, you will find out how to do it as well. This is the Wet Fly Swing Podcast, where I show you the best places to travel to for fly fishing, how to find the best resources and tools to prepare for that big trip, and what you can do to give back to the fish species you love. Hey, I'm Dave, host of the Wet Fly Swing Podcast. I've been fly fishing since I was a little kid. I grew up around a fly shop and have created one of the largest fly fishing podcasts in this country. I've also interviewed more of the greatest fly anglers than just about any show in the world. Today, Conway Bowman is going to take us into his wild world of catching mako sharks on the fly. After this show is over, you're going to find out what the hookup and fight of a top predator feels like on a fly rod. You're going to find out where he finds these fish on the fathom curves out of San Diego, and how to pop your fly to these giant fish and find out how far you have to cast to these guys. We're going to get into all this, plus the gear. And the ultimate question we ask Conway today, tarpon versus mako sharks, which one would you choose if you only had one? And the answer might just surprise you. We're heading to San Diego. Let's hit the dock and jump in with Conway Bowman from conwaybowman.com.
So, you know, I grew up in San Diego. I'm a third generation San Diegan. You know, my father, you know, took me fishing from a very early age. From the time I was 2 years old, we were out fishing the local reservoirs. He had a boat. We fished the bays and the oceans. And he was also a very early saltwater fly fisherman. He was a member of the Saltwater Fly Rodders of America, which was the first saltwater fly fishing club in America. And so as a child, you know, we would go out and we would fish the bays, and I would watch him fly fish with a fiberglass rod and an old Medalist reel, and he'd catch a bonita and barracuda on the fly. It was really cool. You know, at that point, I wasn't fly fishing. So, you know, as I said, I was very young. And so, you know, I was just born and raised around the water. So he was also, you know, he was a surfer. He did all sorts of things, but he was a school teacher. But anyway, but I was fortunate as a kid. Every summer, because he was a school teacher, we spent our summers in Stanley, Idaho. So that's where I really learned how to fly fish. He had 2 months off during the summer. We had a little trailer up there. We had friends that owned a wonderful lodge called the Redfish Lake Lodge. And we would just hang up there all summer. And I basically ran wild in the Sawtooth Mountains with a fly rod. And that's where I learned how to do it. But in the winter, you know, we would come back to San Diego, you know, fall, winter, school year. We'd come back to San Diego. So I got my fly fishing chops fishing the local lakes around San Diego and the bay. And it just kind of, you know, went from there. And I always had a passion for fishing. And so, oh boy, I don't know. I must have been 18, 19, 20 years old, something like that. No, you know, I wasn't. I was 16. Mm. That's right. Because my dad actually back. That's right. One of my first experiences. So I got so into saltwater fly fishing. I used to read all these great books in my dad's library about, you know, about fly fishing around the world for tarpon and billfish. And I was intrigued by that. So anyway, I bought a boat when I was 16. Hmm. And it was a little junky, kind of an aluminum boat. And, you know, I asked my dad, hey, can you drive this trailer down to the bay for me and back it in? And, you know, I want to go fishing. He said, okay. So first day I get the boat, it's got like a 30 horse Johnson tiller control motor on it or something like that. Maybe it's 25. And so we launched the boat. He said, okay, so I'll meet you back here at, you know, whatever, 4 o'clock. He said, when you go out in the bay, don't go out in the open ocean. He said, make a right-hand turn instead of a left-hand turn. So if I made a left-hand turn, I'm going out through the jetties into the open ocean. Make a right-hand turn, I'm going back into the bay. So we launched the boat and I get out to the channel marker buoys and I look right to the back of the bay. I look left to the outside where the jetties are. I look right again to the back of the bay. And then I look left and I made a left-hand turn and went right out.
On purpose.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember going out there and the waves, they weren't huge, but I mean, in a small aluminum boat, it was pretty big.
Like a 16 foot boat, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Aluminum boat. So anyway, so of course You know, I didn't do what he asked me to do. You know, I got back, but it was kind of cool because I got out there. And at that moment, when I got past the jetties and past the surf line, I realized what a vast and beautiful, you know, ocean was right out in front of my house. And I had experienced that with my dad, but in a bigger boat.
Yeah.
But in that little small skiff all by myself, it was sort of an awakening moment for me. So that's when it really started. And then, you know, I just plunked around with fly fishing and fishing, conventional fishing, got out of fishing for a while. You know, I played in a band. I toured in a band when I was in college. You know, during our fall and spring break, we would all pile into a van. And we would tour the West Coast. We'd go from San Diego all the way to British Columbia.
Nice. What was the name of the band?
It was called Dark Globe. It was kind of a punk rock band back in the grunge days in the early 90s. And so, And so I did that. And at that period of my life, I was kind of out of fishing. But there was sort of this moment I had when I was playing with that band on tour. We were driving into Vancouver. And we're going over this bridge. And I looked down and I saw a guy fly fishing. And I'm looking out the window of this van going, man, I need to be doing that. I mean, that's what I really want to do. I really don't want to be sitting in a van, and I don't want to really be a professional musician and, you know, have this aspiration and this dream of being a rock star, which was kind of a joke. Anyway, so that was really the moment that got me really back into fly fishing. And then from there, it just took me off and I got into fly fishing for Mako sharks, you know, and it was kind of a long process. I had a friend that was a commercial fisherman. And we were talking one day, he's like, he said, man, you ought to try fly fishing for Mako sharks. I'm like, what? He goes, yeah. He goes, you know, you can sight fish to them. They jump like crazy. I'm like, really? And I was always fascinated by fish that jump like tarpon and marlin.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I think at that point I had a second aluminum boat. It was 17 feet. So it was bigger than the other one. And I did the same thing. I took that small aluminum boat offshore. I was taking that thing 10 miles offshore looking for sharks. And then finally, after about 3 years, I found my first Mako. And then from there, I figured it out. And then here I am today talking to you about fly fishing for Mako sharks.
That's right. And you kind of, you know, it's interesting. You had a couple of crossroads. You had the one where you're out there as a kid, a 16-year-old, you know, left or right. And, you know, you chose the left route. And then you also had the kind of the rock star thing, like you were trying to be a rock star, but you turned out actually you are kind of, do you feel like you're kind of a rock star in the fly fishing space a little bit? Do you see that a little bit?
Not really. No, you know, I'm like the world's, sometimes I look at myself as the world's tallest midget. You know, it's like, you know, what I do, you know, even in fly fishing, it's so odd. It really is different. And I think I get the recognition because I target something that nobody else really targets.
Right. That's why it is. So that's what it is for you. Basically your name's out there. I mean, when you hear Mako or your name, I mean, they're just interchangeable, right? That's what people hear or think of.
Yeah. And it's because I've always focused on that. I haven't tried to divert myself into being the best, you know, trout fisherman or tarpon, whatever, because the Mako shark is what I have right out my back door. And I've been very blessed because they have been a wonderful asset to my life. And they really have brought a lot of joy and a lot of success.
Yeah, that's cool. Right on. So we're going to dig in a little bit on the Mako and talk about that. The interesting thing, because it's one of those species where, you know, you got to go out with you. Like, that's the interesting thing. I mean, you must be booked up, I'm sure, because like, who else, if you want to go catch a Mako on a fly, are there anybody else doing it? Or are you the only one?
Not really, not anymore. There was a time when there were a handful of guys that were doing it. And, you know, it got to a point back in the, boy, it must have been like around 2007 to 2013 or something. Like, anyway, I had so much business. I had to hire and train guides to help me out. I had three boats. So I had three boats and I had two guides that worked with me for a long time. And they were doing it. And then it's sort of, you know, guiding for a big game species like a Mako shark, number one, it's very taxing on the body. They're large fish. It's a hard day on the water. You're out there in oceans that, I mean, by and large are pretty calm, but you're still on the ocean and you're on the ocean for, you know, they're long days and you're dealing with this very large fish that can be very, very strong and dangerous and beat you up around the boat. And so over the course of a few years, that kind of grinds you down. I think that's what happened to the guys that worked for me. The other thing is, you know, I live in Southern California, and, you know, to be a guide here, number one, it's very expensive to live here. You have no place you can park your boat. you know, this isn't like Florida where you can, you know, have a boat, you know, in your driveway, and we have very few launch ramps. So my boat's on the water. I live here, so I'm already in. So it's sort of like, you know, just the way San Diego is set up in terms of, you know, how costly it is to live here. You definitely have to have a side hustle, even if you guide, because you have a very short season as well. Or if you only fly fish mako sharks, you know, you have a, your season is from May to like October, but you know, it's, there are not a lot of gigs going around. So I think that's what happened. I would suck a lot of the, because these guys, you know, they basically, after they worked for me, they tried to start their business up, and I was like, go for it. You know, I'm busy as I want to be. But I think what happened with me is I still sucked a lot of that business away because, you know, and I don't want to be arrogant, but because I pretty much started it, everybody kind of wanted to fish with the guy who started it.
Sure, right?
Right. And so, yeah. So, you know, I don't really like talking like that, but that's just kind of a fact. And it's sort of like, well, right. So over the years, I think I'm the only guy left.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm back to where I started.
You're still doing it. Awesome. So, well, let's talk a little about the Mako. I'm interested because, I mean, we've done some big game stuff. I know it seems like fly fishing now is you know, any species in the world, right? Go pick your species and figure out how to catch it. You know, the bluefin, you know, whatever it is. But this is interesting because we are talking about sharks, right? So what is, why the Mako? Why not the any other shark out there? Or is this the main shark that's just the easiest one to take on a fly?
Well, the Mako shark is really the only shark that is a true game fish, meaning that they are true predators. You don't see them feeding on dead whales. They're actually a predator. So they track their prey and they attack live food items. So whether it's a tuna, a bonita, a sea lion, a porpoise, whatever, they're actually tracking that. So they're very similar to a, you know, a blue or black marlin, you know, that they're getting behind their prey and they're chasing it down and they're attacking it. The other thing is what makes them a great game fish is they're the only shark that jumps 20 feet out of the water. And they're the only shark that rivals any big game fish in the ocean, whether it's a marlin or, you know, game fish that jump. So marlins, you know, sailfish, wahoo, the Mako is by far the most acrobatic fish in the ocean.
Oh,
period.
Wow. Really?
And you'll talk to any big game angler, whether they fly fish or not. And they will say the Mako shark is probably the greatest adversary in the ocean.
Crazy.
Because they eat all those, they eat blue marlin, they eat black marlin, they eat sailfish, they eat all that stuff. So they're the top dog when it comes to the ultimate sort of game fish.
Wow. Yeah, that's really cool. So yeah. This is it. And so these guys are jumping. What does that look like? Maybe take us on the water. Talk about how do you, you know, once you, let's just go to the hookup. So once you get a fish, take us there. You're getting ready to hook this fish. Describe how that all process works.
So what happens is the sharks will come into the boat and they'll just bait and they have no fear. So they're basically sizing you up. They're hunting you down, basically. That's how that works. Because we're setting a chum slick, usually fresh tuna, and they'll find the boat. And I use a small boat. It's a 24-foot bay boat, and that helps bring in like larger fish. Anyway. So they'll come into the boat and they're basically eyeballing you and they're 30 feet from the boat and they're circling around and you basically take a very large marlin type popper. So it's about 8 to 12 inches long with a big foam head on it. You make a cast about 30 feet out and you just basically start stripping it along the surface and they come up, they get right behind it and they grab it. And it's not a really violent take. It's a very soft take. It's really, people think that this apex predator is going to come in and attack the fly. They don't. They're very cautious. They look at it and they'll grab it. So it's sort of like a brown trout rising on a big fat hopper. You know, they just come up, grab it. They grab that and then you have to wait for them to turn away from the boat. Once they turn away and they're heading away, that's when you set the hook. If you set the hook and they're coming out the boat, they can jump in the boat.
Oh, Jesus.
Because once they feel that hook, they go crazy. It's like sticking a, you know, electrical cord in them. They go nuts.
Have you ever had a shark in the boat?
I have. Yes. And it's not great. It's very dangerous. So that's why, especially with big Makos. And when I talk about a big Mako, that's a Mako shark that's, you know, over 200 pounds, could be up to 800 pounds or bigger. You do not want anything that size coming near the boat. That's why you have to wait for them to turn away.
Gotcha.
So it's cast, take, turn away, and then set the hook.
Wow.
And then they're going away.
What could it do if they, could they, I mean, could it like hit the boat? Do they hit the boat occasionally?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. They'll charge the boat and ram it. Jeez. Yeah, big ones do that quite often. Yeah. Or they'll circle around and they'll grab like the they'll grab the outboard, like they'll grab the anti-cavitation plate in the keel of an outboard, because there's a zinc anode under the anti-cavitation plate, and they'll grab that because the zinc anode creates an electrical current in the water that drives them crazy. They're right on that, and so they'll grab that and they won't let go of the motor. I had one a number of years ago. It was huge. This thing was probably 800 pounds. Had the motor in its mouth, and it was basically swimming the stern of the boat in kind of a circle. Like it wouldn't let go of it. It was the weirdest thing. So now once you hook them, they turn, they run away, then they start jumping, and a mako shark will clear the water three times its body length. So you got to, let's say you have a 9-foot mako. That thing's getting almost 20 feet out of the water.
Wow. Can you see those? Do you have any videos out there? Could you just search that to see a mako?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Just go to my Instagram page there. I have them all over that. Or just go to Jumping Mako.
Yeah.
And you'll see them. And they are the most dynamic game fish in the world. And like I said, any big game angler, whether they fly fish or conventional, they're going to say that is the baddest fish in the ocean right there.
Yeah.
And it's so funny. And I've been on a fair amount of, billfish conventional trips. And when a mako shows up, they're like, oh boy, people get really ramped up. And then you see the marlin just take off.
They're gone. Yeah.
Oh, they're out of there.
Yeah. I don't know my sharks very well, but of course everybody always goes back to the jaws, right? The jaws, sort of the great white sort of thing. But are there other sharks out in your area? Are there lots of sharks down where you're at, out of San Diego?
There are. So we have the short fin mako. We have blue sharks, hammerheads, and great whites. So we have great whites here as well.
You do?
Yeah, all of them. But the one you target for a fly rod is most of the time is a mako. That's what you want. That's the one, yeah.
Imagine yourself surrounded by pristine waters, towering mountains, and the thrill of landing a trophy fish like the majestic Arctic grayling or the elusive bull trout. Take a look for yourself at nradventures.com/wetflyswing and discover the Northern Rockies like never before. That's N as in Northern, R as in Rockies, adventures.com. You support this podcast by checking in at nradventures.com. Trout Routes is the most comprehensive mapping app for trout anglers. With over 50,000 trout streams, 350,000 access points, public land maps, and more, Trout Routes is the number one resource for navigating, researching, and exploring trout streams. You can download Trout Routes for free in the App Store today. Just search for Trout Routes on your phone and take your exploration to the next level. That's Trout Routes, TROUTROUTES. And what does it look like once they're on, they're running? I mean, how long typically is a fish on? I guess it depends on size, but how's that look?
Oh, geez. Well, man, they could be on anywhere from 15 minutes to 3.5 hours. Depends on the fish. Yeah. I had a guy on a fish a couple of years ago, 3 hours and 45 minutes. And we got it to the boat. It was probably, it was close to 500 pounds. So, but a lot of those fish, a lot of those big ones, they'll run, they'll jump. And then at some point the angler gives up because I run these fish down. I run them down on my boat.
Oh, you run them down. Sure.
You have to, because they'll just keep going. So a lot of these big fish, you can only get them so close to your boat. They're not going to come into it. So it could be, 50 feet, and they'll just keep staying 50 feet away from you. So therefore, a lot of times I'll just do it's just a leader release. So I use long leaders. I use like a 12-foot leader. I'll touch the leader and I'll just pop the leader, because I have I call it a fuse box. It's a very light tippet close to the steel leader. So I can get out of that situation if I have to. And a lot of times that's what happens. Anglers, they get worn out. They get worn out a lot of times after about an hour.
Sure.
Because it is a very, very hard, hard fight. So.
Wow. What's it look like when you land them, though? How do you do that? How do you land them?
So I've got a release stick. It's a 4-foot release stick. It's a stick. It's got an open-ended stainless steel kind of U-shaped hook on it, bent at a 90-degree angle. And so what we'll do is we'll leader that fish in. And this is, I can handle fish up to about 200, 250 pounds around the boat. Mm. So we'll leader them in. Okay, I'll touch the leader. I'll move that leader up to the stick. And then I'll go ahead and put that release stick in the corner of their mouth where the hook is. and I'll just apply pressure, and then that pressure just releases them. And I use all barbless folks too, so that makes it really easy. And then once you release them, they swim away. They don't, you know, when you happen to the boat, they're fairly calm at that point. They're kind of, they're not really worn out, but they're kind of like, eh, you know,
yeah,
eh. You know, they're ready to be released.
Right.
Yeah, they know. And so you just release them, they swim away. And I do all catch and release. I've never killed a Mako, you know, ever since I started this. So.
Right. God, this is amazing. Yeah, this is just I see why. Yeah, it's a unique thing. I mean, this is a fish that is top of the food chain, and it's got, you just look at it and you're like, wow, that is definitely something you don't want to mess with.
Oh, they're the baddest fish in the ocean. You know, so large Mako sharks, their primary food item is the swordfish. And the swordfish is one of the gnarliest creatures in the ocean. They'll charge your boat and stick their sword, jeez, their bill right through your boat. They're that aggressive. So a Mako shark, that's what they eat, the big ones. So we have a lot of swordfish out here too. So that's kind of a neat, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing. Sometimes you'll see a swordfish on the surface out here, and you'll see a Mako shark circling around it, ready to make the kill. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm looking at a picture. I don't know who this is, but there's a picture online of somebody holding the Mako's up on the edge of the boat, and the guy's holding it.
That's not good.
No.
Yeah, that's not me.
No.
Yeah, you don't do that. Yeah, you're always rolling the dice when you do that. And, you know, it makes a neat picture, but it also, it could end up being a really bad scenario, somebody getting bitten, or it's just not good lifting a shark up out of the water, because if you look at its belly, they're putting all the pressure on its liver, and once that liver gets damaged, they can die. So that's why you should never take a shark out of the water ever.
Yeah, and I'm looking at it now. Yeah, I'm just looking at random photos, and I got one. They some guys are holding up. They killed this one, and it's sitting on their cooler. So yeah, there's all sorts of. I guess that's it. It's not against the law to kill these things.
Oh no, a lot of guys kill them. Yeah, and they're good. They're good to eat.
Oh, they are, but, right.
You know. Oh, they're very well. So basically, if you order swordfish in most restaurants, it's probably Mako shark, because you cannot tell the difference between the flesh. You can't do it. So, and it's an easier target than a swordfish. So, you know, that's kind of the big secret in the restaurant and fish industry, is that, you know, they sell Mako shark as swordfish.
Gotcha. Do you have any idea, you know, we are always talking about, you know, conservation, all that stuff, but, you know, how they're doing? Is it something where you can tell while you're fishing out there, or have any idea on the numbers?
You know, it's hard to tell. I do know this. They banned long lining out here in California. And we're seeing more and more Mako sharks now, bigger ones too. So I think that's helping. The purse seiners are pushed offshore. So the California conservation measures are pretty good, but that doesn't really count down in Mexico, which is only 20 miles south of me. But to be honest with you, I think that we're seeing good numbers of Makos. And San Diego is a breeding area for Mako sharks. So we have these big females that come up and they pup here, you know, anywhere from May through August. And so we have a good population of baby Makos, medium-sized Makos, and very large Makos. So it looks good. It looks good.
Yeah.
And also, there's a presence of a bluefin tuna out here also. And that's a great food item for Makos. So because the food item's here, the Makos are here as well. So
yeah.
Yeah. So it looks good so far. But there's no solid data on Mako sharks. I wish there was. Yeah.
Gotcha. I'm just kind of searching around here I'm looking at some of these flies. Yeah. I mean, the fly you use, is it, so what are you imitating? What are you trying to imitate with the fly?
Gee, you know, it's funny. I started using poppers a few years, well, probably 10 years ago. I used to see Makos come into a slick and they try to grab seabirds off the surface.
Oh.
And I was always using a subsurface fly. And that was good, but sometimes it was hard to see the hook, the take and all that stuff. So I started keeping the fly floating on the surface. And I honestly think they think there's some sort of seabird, just the way they grab it. And so since then, I've gone pretty much strictly to poppers.
To poppers. Okay, cool. Yeah, I'm just looking at I guess this is a Fly Lords blog post, but 7 sharks you can catch on a fly sort of thing. And of course, the guy's got his fly rod on his back. He's holding a shark, but it seems like, to me, I mean, just the outside, I've never fished for shark. I mean, I would be pretty afraid to be in the water with the shark. Like, is this something that, it sounds like the Makos for sure. Are there other species that you've heard of out there where people are catching them on the fly that, you know, it's maybe a different situation where you could actually target them not from a boat, or what, do you know much about that?
Well, yeah, leopard sharks. Guys target leopard sharks off the beach. They're a very passive shark.
Oh, okay.
They eat crustaceans.
Sure.
But that's it. I mean, it's either leopards, Makos, or you can target blue sharks too. And I do that in the wintertime. Blue sharks are really fun, but they don't jump. they're a great fight, but they don't jump. But it's the same process. You throw poppers at them, you know, they come up and grab the popper off the surface.
God, this is great. I'm looking at it again. I'm just going to, we'll highlight, we'll put a link to this, to the fly lures, but they got the seven sharks, black tip, bone, bonnet. Is it bonnet?
Bonnet head.
Bonnet head. Oh, bonnet head. Yeah. Leopard shark. You got black nose. You got lemon shark, bull shark. And then the final one is mako. Of course, the mako is the most vicious looking of the sharks.
Absolutely.
So that's it. It's got the crazy teeth. Like all these other sharks have kind of like little mini teeth, but the mako is just unbelievable.
They're like daggers. And I tell you, if they grab a hold of you, you're
done. You'll lose. Rip your arm off.
You're done. Well, what they'll do is they'll tear right through all your tendons. So your hand will come out looking like a piece of hamburger. Like they're not going to bite your fingers off, but you're going to be totally mangled. Yeah, it is. It's not good. I would honestly rather have my fingers bit off cleanly than just, you know, have a bunch of, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah.
What is the, do you know, tell us about, you know, kind of the fish itself, like the life history. Do you know, like, where I guess it sounds like they spawn up near out of San Diego, and then do they migrate a long ways and then come back, or how's that look?
Yeah, you know, nobody really knows. So the Southern California Bight where I live, that's definitely a breeding area for mako sharks. And they say it's one of three. So you have Southern California, you have New Zealand, and there's one off Africa, I think. Anyway, so they come in usually in May, and the big ones are in here, the big females, and they drop their pups. And typically they'll have anywhere 5 to 10 pups that, and they live birth them. And those little guys are swimming around. And the interesting thing is when the little pups are in vitro in the mom, they're eating the weaker ones. So the mom will start off with, let's say, 20 pups in vitro, but the most dominant ones will eat the weaker ones. And then the ones that come out are like ready to go. So that's how vicious these things are, you know? So anyway, so the mom has the pups. The pups hang around the Southern California Bight till they're probably, you know, probably a couple hundred pounds, because it's a safer environment for them. Their food item is more, you know, smaller tunas, bonitas, barracudas. But once they get into that 300, 400, 500 pound range, then they start changing. They're eating porpoise. They're eating larger tunas. They're also eating, you know, seals and sea lions. And that's when they're 800 to 1,000 pounds. That's when they start targeting those mammal species. But, you know, so we have all that right here. So from San Diego all the way up to Long Beach, which is about 70 miles up and probably maybe 100 miles out, that's the Southern California Bight. So they hang around. But what happens in the winter, when the water gets cold, the makos kind of disappear. And I think they go down off of Mexico somewhere. They just kind of disappear. And then they come back. So it's kind of like a tarpon migration. In April, you start seeing your first wave. And then May, a second wave, and then they really start filling in June, July, and August. And then they'll be here all the way through November. I mean, I get makos all the way into November.
Huh. Wow. And so if somebody's listening now and they're interested, I'm not sure, you know, availability for what you have, but just looking ahead, when would be a good time to come down there and try to do this?
I would look mid-May through August. And then I would skip September altogether. It's a weird month. It's just they kind of disappear. I don't know what happens to them. But then October, November, all of October, and then halfway through November is really good. But if I were to pick one month, it would be July. July is just prime time. But you can't go wrong mid-May through August. You just can't.
Yeah, it's all good. And the weather's great. Is the weather typically, I mean, it's San Diego, right? It's amazing.
Oh, my God. It's perfect. It's great. And we don't have big rolling. We have the big seas in the winter. In the summertime, it's very flat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the month that it rains? Isn't there a month when it kind of gets 1 month out of the year where it rains? Isn't that in the spring or something like that?
Well, that's right now. I mean, it's been rain. So what happens? The rain starts in January and goes all the way through like March. And that's our heavy rain season. I mean, rain can start in October. You know, we've had torrential rains, but typically, looking at January through March, that's the heavy rain season.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And what is it sounds like you have your boat out there. Talk about the day, you know, if somebody has a trip with you, what are they doing? What time are they beating out there? And then describe that.
Yeah. So my boat is on the water on Mission Bay. So you basically go to a place called Dana Landing, which is a market, and it's a great market. It's got a deli and all this stuff. My boat is right there. Show up at the market. Supply up, hop in the boat. We're basically fishing within a half hour in the summertime. My first spots are very close to the beach. You know, and that can move. It kind of depends on when the fish are, but a lot of times I check my first spot depending on what the tides are doing. And we fish a pretty long day. You know, we'll leave the dock about, I don't get an early start because you need two things. You need sunlight and you also need a little bit of a breeze on the water to make it really happen. So we'll leave at 8 or 9 in the morning, but we're not back until 6 at night. I really want to maximize the high sun and then the wind or the breeze, because what that does is the high sun gives me the ability to spot the fish as they come to the boat, and the breeze allows the boat to cover as much water as I possibly can within the, you know, within 8 hours or whatever, or how, let's say we're fishing 6 hours, right? So I'm covering all that water. And this is what people have to understand. This is big game hunting. You know, it's not like going out on you know, and you're on a trout stream or, you know, and the fish are staying in one spot. These fish move. So I'm basically, you know, I'm figuring out where these fish are going to be at a specific time. And so they, you know, and that's what it is. So you're basically sitting up. It's kind of like bow hunting. You know, you're sitting up and just waiting for the opportunity to come right in front of you. So there's a lot of downtime. You know, there could be, you know, 3 hours of downtime. Then all of a sudden, boom, there's a 500-pound mako right at the boat. So I find that big game hunters really understand this. They get it because they've been trained to be very patient and waiting for that great opportunity. Now, there are days when we'll go out and we'll have a fish every half hour, every hour, you know? So it just kind of depends.
Gotcha. Wow.
Yeah.
That's it. So you're out there.
And that's basically it.
That's it. Pretty much just hanging out there.
Yeah. But the great thing is this. You know, a lot of times when you fish other places, you have to meet at the ramp and you have to take a 2-hour boat ride and, you know, on and on and on. And you get out to your fishing spot at, like, you know, what, 11 o'clock after, you know, getting up at 3 in the morning. The great thing, what I do is we maximize the fishing time because I'm not fishing very far from where my boat is at any time.
Yeah.
And the other thing is I have a very fast boat, so I can get from point A to point B very quickly. And we get comments about that all the time. It's like, guy, I mean, we're really fishing a lot. You know, we didn't have to meet you at the ramp. We didn't have to drive and do this and get bait. And
Right, just go for it.
We just were on the water. So we're covering a lot of water and which is, you know, obviously bringing in more fish.
Gotcha. How do you find, when you're out there, how do you find the fish? It sounds like are there areas where you've caught them before and they're always coming back through those areas?
Yes. So I fish fathom curves. Those are kind of like drop offs. And so we have a lot of canyons, little, you know, offshore or near shore canyons, ocean canyons where I live. And so at certain tides, the water will move through those little canyons and create a current. And the sharks kind of funnel up through those currents. They're either coming down with the current or moving up through it. So you're basically finding those currents and just sitting in that general area. And then you're drifting down those fathom curves or those canyon lines or those drop-offs.
Every angler knows the importance of impeccable gear. Jackson Hole Fly Company's fly rod combo kits are a culmination of passion, persistence, and craftsmanship. Hand-picked and curated with care, each kit is designed to provide an unparalleled fly fishing experience. From the novice setting their eyes on the water for the first time with our beginner-friendly Crystal Creek combo to the all-inclusive Flat Creek kit designed for seasoned pros. Adventures, the lightweight Fall Creek combo ensures you carry your passion on every backpacking journey. Streamer enthusiasts, let the White River kit capture your imagination. Precision and accuracy are non-negotiable for you. The Missouri River combo won't disappoint. Heed the call of the salmon with the Kenai River combo or explore vast salts with the Tarpon Alley kit. And for those who find joy in every facet of sports, there's always a kit tailored to your unique fishing style. Discover your perfect ensemble at jacksonholefflycompany.com. Let's talk gear a little bit. What sort of gear? Who's, you know, you're out there. What are you using? Weight, reels, all that stuff.
So I get this question all the time. I start with like a 14 weight.
Yeah, 14 weight.
And then I bump it up and I have all custom rods above that. I make all my rods one piece rods for really large makos. But, you know, typically a 14 weight from any company that makes them will handle a mako up to about 200 pounds. But once you get over that, you need to go one piece because you really have to be able to put the heat on these fish, especially if you have to lift them. You know, if you have to put the pressure to bring them up, if they sound, you got to do that. And there's really no fly rod that has been able to really do that. So my rods are 8 to 8.5 feet long. I use, you know, a variety of reels. I use all sorts of reels. I'm not locked into any company any company that makes a big game reel for marlin or tuna, those will work fine. But I have, you know, 800 yards of backing on it. I use a sort of a knotless kind of a, they call it a, like a wind on leader system. So I have the backing that goes to 100-pound monofilament, high visibility mono. Then that goes to a very heavy shooting head, 650 grain shooting head. That shooting head, I have a piece of 80-pound monofilament that goes off that. It's about 12 feet long. And then from that, at the end of that monofilament, I have a very short piece of 30-pound. And then that's put onto my steel leader, which is only about 2 feet long. And then I use a tube fly and then a 10-aught hook. So the tube fly slides up and down the leader. And so the reason why that works is when I release a fish and I have to break that fuse box tippet, that light tippet, it pops off and it floats and I can get it back.
Nice. Oh, right. There you go.
And it doesn't leave the fly hanging out of the shark's mouth. So that's great. So I get the fly back. The shark doesn't have a big old thing hanging out of its mouth. And it is only a 2-foot piece of leader hanging out. And they basically shake that out because it's a barbless hook. So that's basically the rig. And you're not throwing more than 30 feet ever. And the other thing is the casting technique is interesting. It's basically an anchor cast. So you basically make a front haul and a back haul. And on your back haul, you anchor the fly behind you. Let the fly anchor in the water and then just basically shoot it forward. And then it shoots the big fly straight out. So it's a really efficient cast. You're not doing some river runs through it, you know, false cast. You don't do that.
No.
It isn't efficient. Some guys try to do it, but I just want the fly to get from point A to point B because the Mako will find that fly. Once it's on the water, they'll find it. They'll grab it.
Oh, they will. So how close do you have to get to the Mako to just, it looks like they have pretty good eyesight.
Oh, they have great eyesight. You can put that thing 30 feet away and make one big pop and they'll see it and come grab it.
Right.
So you don't have to be right on them. And a lot of times you don't want to put it right in front of them because they're so big. One swoop of their tail, they'll go right past the fly because they have a lot of momentum when they're moving. People don't realize that. They'll cover 6 feet in one tail swipe. One movement of the tail, they're 6 feet away from you. So you really have to put it way out in front of them and they'll find it. And they have great eyesight and they look up a lot. They'll roll over and they'll look up or they'll even take their eyes and put them out of the water. Like they'll get their nose out of the water. Yeah. So don't worry about being accurate because you don't have to be accurate at all.
Just get out there. And then the popping is you're just imitating kind of either like a wounded bird or wounded fish.
Exactly. Sometimes it's one pop. Sometimes just keep stripping it very slowly. Or what I'll do is I'll swing the rod tip. I'll throw it out and I'll just sweep the rod tip left or right and let it kind of move across the surface. And sometimes that triggers a very aggressive strike. Like they'll as the Mako gets closer to it, the bird is trying to get away and then they get pissed off and they grab it. And that can be an aggressive strike. Yeah. But I don't expect people to really know how to do that. I mean, I can do it, but all I want are people just to basically hook this thing. So just get the fly out there, make a strip, watch the take, and then hold on.
Wow. And pink is the color. Is that the best color?
You know, orange is what I orange and red.
Orange and red. Okay.
Orange. You can pretty much any color works, but orange and red because I can really see it very well too.
Yeah,
that's great. Gotcha. You want to see that? You want to be able to see the fly.
Wow. How do you keep from losing a Mako when it's jumping 20 feet in the air?
Yeah, you basically just hold on. So it's not like a tarpon. You can't bow to them because what a Mako does when they jump, they go straight down. They go very deep and then they come straight up like a rocket and they launch themselves. So there's always tension in the line. There's always tension in the water. So that's always keeping the hook in the corner of their mouth. The only time you'll lose them is if they roll on the leader and they snap it. And that happens sometimes, not all the time. Most of the time, they'll make it through the jumps with the system that I use.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
That's right. So even the giant jumps, you're not losing a lot of fish on the jumps.
No, not at all. Not at all.
That's amazing. Yeah. So, yeah, this is cool. I mean, the picture, this is kind of what, you know, I was thinking, and it's pretty amazing. When your dad, it sounds like, you know, your dad was the person that planted the seed. Were Makos not on the radar back when he was doing the saltwater stuff back in the day?
Oh, no. My dad was afraid of sharks. I only took him shark fishing once. He's like, I don't like this. I mean, here's this guy that was sort of the spitting image of Ernest Hemingway.
Yep.
He was afraid of sharks. It was so awesome. Yeah, I took him out one day. He's like, that was fun, but I'll never do that again.
Right.
No, he was more of a, kind of a Bonita Barracuda fisherman. And then, you know, then he really got into, I mean, trout fishing. I mean, he was a Spring Creek guy and then he loved to bird hunt. So for his saltwater stuff, it was much more tame game than what I was
doing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, I think he thought I was crazy. I mean, he's like, God, you're freaking nuts. I'm like, oh, you know, whatever. Right. Thanks, Dad.
There you go. There you go. That's awesome. And I mean, are any skills, the trout fishing, any of the other fight, is that any of that transfer over to this? It sounds like it's just totally different. I mean, there's
nothing. No. This is a whole, well, yeah, I'm just have just the appreciation of fly fishing. That's about it. Leave. You know, that's it. Know that, you know, but yeah, not really.
Yeah.
Whole different, this is like the Mount Everest of fly fishing. It's like, whatever, you know, it's, and still, honestly, it's uncharted waters because the fish are getting bigger and I'm trying to figure out, you know, how I'm going to deal with these fish.
Oh, right. And what do you mean by getting bigger? How the fish are getting bigger?
So when I first started doing this, a big mako was 150 pounds. And now we're seeing fish that are 800 to 1,000 on a consistent basis.
Oh, wow. And why is that? Is that because of conservation measures or why is that?
I think it's conservation measures. I think it's the presence of the bluefin tuna that have been coming into San Diego for the last 10 years. They weren't present when I first started doing this. And so, you know, it has to do with the ocean ecology just changing, ocean conditions. So, yeah. So we have more great whites now. We have more big makos. We have, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff going on down here. So, and things are just changing. And that's what happens. And I was reading some old logs from Zane Grey. And 100 years ago, they had a presence of bluefin tuna and big giant mako sharks 100 years ago off Catalina. So I think we're back in that cycle.
Oh, right. Yeah, natural cycle potentially.
Yep.
Wow. So bigger fish and I mean, how big do you think these fish, I mean, can you handle like with your 24-foot boat?
The biggest one I've ever got to the boat, I estimated it 600 pounds.
Yeah.
You know, and that was a very, very, that was a large mako. I've hooked them bigger than that. I hooked them, you know, 800 to 1,000. And I've hooked a fair number of those fish. I had a guy on last year. He hooked it. He was hoping that he was going to get this thing to the boat. This thing was 1,000 pounds. And I'm like, okay, dude, let's try this. And so about an hour into it, he said, I'm done.
Yeah.
He was completely cooked. But this shark jumped 10 times. We chased it down. The guy finally just said, I'm done. And I just broke the leader.
Wow.
But it was an amazing experience.
10 times.
In fact, you know what? Geez. If you go to my Instagram, yeah, there's a clip, a recent clip, a video clip of a guy with a 500-pound mako hooked up. That was the first mako caught last year. I think it was May 15th. But that's a large mako. Like, you'll just see the shark jumping.
Yeah.
But that's a good example of how big the fish are.
Gotcha. Wow, yeah.
But it's pretty cool.
Perfect. So, I mean, I feel like this is fairly straightforward, right? I mean, obviously, you're the only guy in town that can do this. So if people want to connect on this, they can, I guess, go to your website or on social and just check in to see your availability.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. And yeah, just come on out and give it a shot. I mean, it's just do it once. I always tell people, you'll either dig it or you'll go, that was cool, but it was a little too freaking weird, you know, or it was a little too extreme, you know, but I'll tell you, even aside from hooking a mako shark, just watching one come to my boat is unbelievable. You'll never see anything like that on Shark Week. Like I always say, it's Shark Week every day on my boat. And you're seeing the greatest predator right within, you can reach down and touch them if you wanted to do that.
That's right. Have you had, what's the guy's name? You mentioned Shark Week. Who's the guy that has the program, the giant, I can't remember the name. Oh. You know who I'm talking about.
The monster fish.
Yeah, dude? Monster fish guy. Has he been?
Oh, Jeremy Wade.
Yeah.
No. I'd love to get him out here.
There you go. We got to work on that. That would be awesome to have.
That would be hilarious. He'd probably want to like float tube for him.
Exactly. Something. Right. You got the nice. Good. So, and what do you, you also do some like hosted, right? You're traveling around after the season. Is that what you're doing? Traveling around, hitting some hosted programs. Yeah.
Yeah. So I do a couple hosted trips a year. So this year I'm going to, every year I try to go to the Yucatan for permit. Last year I went to the Amazon. So I just I just reach out to people. Hey, where do you want to go this year? And they'll say, I want to do this or that. So it could be going to El Salto for largemouth bass on a fly, you know, whatever. But, so I like doing that. So it keeps things kind of fresh. And then, but you know, summertime it's full speed mako sharks on the fly. And that's what I'm doing.
That's it. How does tarpon, it sounds like there's no comparison, but I mean, tarpon's always the one species you hear a lot of, like, hey, this is the number one if I had to choose one. How does that compare tarpon versus the makos?
Well, I mean, honestly, if I had one fish to choose, it would be a tarpon.
It would.
But I just don't have them in my backyard. They're the most magnificent creature on a fly, period.
Why is tarpon versus, say, the mako? I mean, what's the, it sounds like this mako's jumping way out of the water, going crazy.
you know, it's convincing a tarpon to take a fly.
Yeah.
You're convincing a massive fish to hit a very small fly during the day. And they're nocturnal feeders by and large. So you're trying to get that fish to take a fly. That's the thing. Feeding them, making sure you figure out how to get them to eat. You can get a mako to eat any day. I mean, they're just there and they're there to eat and kill.
Gotcha.
A tarpon is during the day, they're moving from point A to point B and they're not, their head is not in a feeding mode during the day. So you're throwing a small fly and trying to just convince them and move that fly at a perfect speed just to get them to trigger their feeding or predatory instinct to attack that fly. That's what I like about it. So it's an art. It really is. And that's why it's so difficult. And that's why I like it so much. So it's just like Spring Creek, you know, trout fishing. I love doing that because it's very difficult. Dry flies, downstream presentations. I like all that, all the nuance of that, all the technical part of that. But the mako shark is just a big, big fish that is relatively easy to hook. But to watch that thing jump, there's nothing like it in the world.
Yeah, that's it. That's nice. Cool. Well, let's take it out here really quick with our, you know, we were talking conservation. So let's do a conservation shout out. I'm not sure if you have any, like if we want to take that conversation a little bit further and learn more about makos and kind of some of the stuff down in your area. Are there any groups or any people you'd recommend we could check in with?
Oh, man.
We just had the Bonefish Tarpon Trust on because we're doing some stuff on, like you said, the permit and some of that and some other areas. But it feels like you're in this really unique place. Like, I don't know. It seems like San Diego is just its own little thing. You know, like fly fishing is never, you don't hear much as much down there, right?
And, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're in a corner of the earth that people just don't really, they only know about it just because of just, you know, word of mouth or just.
Yeah.
You know,
well, what are the other species? I'll let you think if there was a conservation, but are there other species down there other than this that people are fly fishing for? I mean, there's plenty of those, right?
You have like the bluefin tuna. People are starting to do that a little bit. You've got a thing called a corvina or corvina, corvina, which is a cool fish.
That's right.
They're on the beach.
Yep.
But other than that, not really. I mean, it's just, but then again, I got to be honest, because I'm so focused on makos, I don't really. Yeah, that's really all I want to catch on a fly down here, to be honest with you, because it's really the only big game species you can sight fish to and watch the take.
Oh, right. Yeah.
That's why. And that's why I love tarpon fishing. And that's why I love, you know, because you're engaged
with hunting, that fish. Right.
You're hunting and then it's a one-on-one thing with that fish. When you're fishing bluefin tuna on a fly, you're throwing into a foam or stripping and hooking. That's fine. But there's not a personal connection to a specific fish. And that's what I love most about mako sharks.
Perfect. Good. Well, we'll leave it there. And I got a couple of quick random ones for you. I can't leave the band. The music is great. So we got the Dark Globe. We'll try to look up something there. But what do you listen to now? Like if you had to say a band or type of music, what's your, you know, if you're on a road trip, what do you listen to? Are you listening to, you know, out there?
God almighty. I listen to a lot of Ryan Adams and alt country and Americana.
Oh, okay.
Now.
Yeah. Alt country. Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah, I mean, I still play in a band.
That
band
you do? Oh, so you still play?
A couple times a year we'll get a show together. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. And it's so, but that kind of music we play, I don't listen to. You know, it's kind of anymore. Probably just because, you know, I got my brains beat out with it for so many years. I want something more mellow. So, but I listen to, you know, a lot of jazz. I listen, you know, alt country stuff. I have just a mix of music I listen to. So, yeah, I don't know.
There you go.
More mellow stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So Ryan Adams, not Brian Adams, of course. We're talking Ryan Adams.
Adams, not Brian Adams. No.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. And how about podcasts? Yeah. Do you listen to any podcasts or you do any of that when you're on the road?
Joe Rogan sometimes. Milhouse. I listen to Milhouse. Who else?
Any other non-fishing outdoor related podcasts? I guess Rogan's Rogan's kind of non. Yeah, Rogan's does everything.
He's great because he's all over the map.
Yeah,
he covers a lot of different subjects. I love that. And so, but you know, I got to be honest. When I drive, a lot of times it's just silence. That's one reason why.
There you go.
I like the ocean too. I go out and it's quiet. All I'm hearing are the waves hitting the boat and just the wind. And that in this point of my life, you know, silence is a really good thing. It's just I really enjoy that. So yeah.
Yep. Perfect. All right, Conway, I think we'll leave it there. I love that we, you know, touched on this. I know you've talked a lot about this in the past, but I think for people that haven't heard about this, I think, you know, it's a great opportunity. I mean, for like, if people are thinking now, you know, we're in 2024, Is there opportunities to fish this year that you have openings, or is this more people you're looking ahead a little further?
You know, August has openings. I'm pretty much booked through July right now, but August definitely, and definitely October. Don't underestimate October. That is a really dynamite month for Mako's.
Okay. October. And they can just head out to conwaybowman.com and just connect with you there.
Yeah. Or it just give me a call. I think my number's on there and I'm around.
Okay. Awesome. All right, Conway. Well, thanks for putting this together. Your name has been bumping around out there for a long time, on the podcast. So I'm glad we finally were able to do this. And excited to keep in touch. And maybe someday I'll be able to get down there and see one of these sharks, and we'll go from there.
I'd love to have you out, Dave. Thank you so much for having me.
There it is. That was a nice quick one. Take a look at some of the photos in the show notes. Take a look at the teeth of these sharks. And I think just compare these sharks to any shark and you will see they're top of the food chain. I'm excited to learn more about this. If you are interested in doing this trip, you can send an email to me, dave@wetflyswing.com. And if we get enough interest from there, I think we can put together a hosted trip potentially down there. I would love to find out if there's enough interest. You can obviously connect with Conway as well and find out if he has availability. We are going to be doing more schools and events all year long. You can head over to wetflyswing.com/schools and find out where we're heading next and what we have going. That's the easiest way to stay in touch. And like always, you can send me an email anytime. All right, I'm going to head out of here. I'm going to leave it there and let you get back on to your day. And I want to say appreciate you for stopping by today and hope you have a great morning, great afternoon, or great evening, wherever in the world you are. Appreciate you for stopping in today, and we'll talk to you soon.